Recently, I was asked to review and critique the sermon of a seminary student who's taking a preaching class this semester. Even before reading a single word of Timothy's trial sermon, the exercise poses an interesting question. How do you judge or evaluate a sermon? Or to pull you into the conversation, what is it that you look for in a sermon? Do you look for creativity and originality? Do you look for a sermon that is logical, well-reasoned, and well-constructed? Do you want a sermon that connects with your heart, that helps you see the world and your own life in new ways, that leads you toward a new and different way of living, that captures your imagination, that has power and passion and urgency to it, that inspires a sense of wonder and beauty, and a desire to love God and neighbor and yourself more completely? Do you look for a sermon that conveys ancient and timeless truths in fresh ways, or that breaks open the stories of Jesus and all the other stories of the Bible as a living, lively, life-giving word for our own day? A sermon that effectively communicates universal and eternal truths, or that speaks a timely and direct word to specific people and communities? Perhaps a sermon that has the power to change lives, both individual lives and our social life and social systems together. Or perhaps a sermon that brings the love and mercy, the grace and healing of God to life. Which of these do you look for in a sermon? And which should I use in judging young Timothy's sermon? When I swapped pulpits with Marty Sorensrell 2 Sundays ago, I received in the mail a few days later a thank you note from one of the parishioners of that congregation, a thank you note that simply has become one of my all-time favorite notes to have received, and which, by the way, suggests one more measuring stick for sermons. Let me read the note to you. Dear Craig, thanks so much for your wonderful service. It was great, as no one fell asleep. Every now and then it's good to get real and get brought back down to earth and remember that probably none of those other purposes could ever happen if we don't at least keep people awake. Some of you may remember when churches would have the signboard up front that would announce last Sunday's attendance, and last Sunday's Sunday school attendance, and last Sunday's offering total as a way of measuring the growth or decline of a congregation. I suspect we should have one more category: how many persons fell asleep during the preacher's sermon. That was not a problem on the first Pentecost day. With flames of fire leaping from head to head and the sound of a mighty wind like that of a hurricane or tornado, or perhaps the primeval howl of creation, with persons from all around the world hearing their own mother tongue being spoken without benefit of Rosetta Stone, falling asleep was the last thing on anyone's mind. Can you picture it? A group of untrained followers of Jesus breaking out of their shell, out of their fear and isolation, and making connections, building bridges with persons they never could or would have imagined in a million lifetimes. Luke records that at the end of that day, following a sermon by Peter, about 3,000 persons were baptized and added to the church. Can you imagine? what that would do to our statistics and turning them in to the conference office, that's some sermon. But it's not just about Peter and his words and his eloquence or his passion and his power. It's about everything that went on that day. The disciples giving up their safety zone and comfort zone, going out into the streets and speaking from their hearts, just from their hearts, about the magnificent and wonderful things, the amazing things that God had done, that they had seen God do and wanted to bear witness to. If you and I are to experience a new Pentecost today, a new infusion of God's grace and power, then it likely begins where the original Pentecost began, with God pushing us out of this room and into the streets, setting us on fire to care deeply and personally for everyone we meet, body and soul, letting them know how much they are loved, not just by us, but even more by God, as revealed in the life and teachings and death and resurrection of Jesus, empowered, made possible by the gift of God's Spirit. But how, we ask, how can we do that? We know how to enroll for classes at OCC or Lemoyne or Syracuse, and if we want to learn French or German or Arabic or any other number of languages, we know how to do that. But how do we learn a different kind of language? How do we learn the language of love and respect that crosses the boundaries that are so difficult for us to cross? The language that leads us beyond ourselves into relationship with those who are different from us, but equally created and loved by God. The church in San Antonio, very much like this one, has been working on that agenda for several years. I learned recently that the Cotons on vacation had visited there some years ago and were quite taken by what they observed there and began to, in their own minds, make some correlation with this congregation and what we might become. The pastors at that time, who have now moved on to other areas of ministry, happen to be friends of mine. They've written a book about their experience there, watching that congregation begin to take seriously the value for themselves, not just the value for others, in learning how to reach out to and connect with the homeless in San Antonio. John reports in that book that at one point a downtown lawyer approached him, recognizing who he was and the work that congregation was inspiring, asking John how possibly he could connect with what he called the guitar man who sat strumming outside his office building every day of the week. What in the world, that lawyer asked, can I do for him? What can I say? John replied, do you really want me to name some possibilities? Is that a question you really want answered? These are honest questions, came the response. And John answered this way, then the next time you see him, ask him his name. He's got to have a name. Surely it would be more respectful to call him by name than just the guitar man. When you find out his name, then take some time and listen to his story. Sit down next to him on the sidewalk. It's hard to feel dignity and respect with someone who towers over you and looks down upon you. Treat him like others. Ask questions like, where are you from? Are you married? Do you have children? What do you like to do during the day? How long have you been on the streets? What do you miss most about life before the streets? Where did you grow up? You have to spend time with him, said John, and listen to his story. We need to stop and listen to all of the stories around us. Later in the book, they list a series of new understandings that began to shape their ministry in relating to those who came from outside the doors of the church. The list includes these items. We need our decisions to be worded in language that is easy to read for those who read at less than a high school level. We need to socialize together, have celebrations and parties together. We need to meet together in less formal settings. We need to have poor and marginalized disciples lead at least half of our devotionals, meditations, and public prayers when we gather. We need to dress less formally and more casually. We need to be inclusive of both conservative and progressive theological perspectives. We need to live out our faith more through our hearts, less through our heads. We need to always search for ways to build trust with persons who happen to be poor. As a congregation, we stand on the brink of an exciting new era in which God is opening paths and doors for us to begin to live and relate and connect like that. To begin to take each other as seriously as we wish to be taken ourselves. To look past the differences. To see the common needs and hungers and hurts and yearnings that lie in the heart and soul of each of us. When the apostles on that first day of Pentecost are driven out by God's Spirit, they go not knowing what to say or how to say it, but they go because they can do no other. They go because God's Spirit pushes them beyond themselves and invites them not to worry about the message they have to say, but how to speak in ways that allow others to hear the great truth of God made known in Jesus Christ, that the God of all creation cares ultimately and loves unconditionally every single human being. If that's the only message we learn how to speak, then it shall be enough. Amen.